From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The Caribbean has brought the world a rich literary gumbo. Think of the poetry of Nobel laureate Derek Walcott from St. Lucia, or the prose of Juno Diaz, who's Dominican-American. Now the island of St. Thomas gives us Tiffany Yannick and her book of short stories, How to Escape from a Leper Colony. Alan Chuse has this review.
The title story immediately carried me away to a Caribbean island off the coast of Trinidad in 1939. On the island is a leper colony, one of whose inhabitants is a 14-year-old Hindu girl named Deepa, who caught the disease from her mother. An island can be a world. That's what one of the older inhabitants explains to Deepa. This title story, in only a dozen pages, makes of this location a real world in which love and prayer, Jesus and Shiva, life and death, pulse through the air like the vital forces of existence Deepa takes them to be. Another of the shorter pieces, called The Bridge Stories, gives us a fanciful Caribbean in which people wear little bridge symbols around their necks, and actual bridges connect many of the islands to each other. Here the writer gives voice to an island itself. Other stories come to life in other voices, as in Street Man, in which a gun-toting drug dealer recounts his complicated affair with a college girl from the States. And then there's the Ghanaian-born guy, suffering from what he describes as canoe sickness, an illness that keeps him from his dream of playing professional soccer. But these longer stories I didn't find either completely satisfying or completely whole. They each had moments, the vitality of a crowded dance floor, the intensity of the first kiss in a new love affair, but the shorter stories stole my affection and make the book worth the buying.
The book is How to Escape from a Leper Colony by Tiffany Yannick. Our reviewer, Alan Chuse, teaches writing at George Mason University.
The internet has played an important role for the political opposition in Iran. A year ago, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was reelected president of Iran in a landslide vote that sparked charges of fraud, massive demonstrations by the opposition, the Green Movement, and powerful cell phone videos uploaded worldwide of a brutal crackdown that followed. AccessNow.org was born in the aftermath of the disputed elections to help Iran's opposition to take their protest online. It's a U.S.-based group of activists who support the Green Movement as it prepares for the one-year anniversary of the elections. Its co-founder, Cameron Ashraf, joins us from Los Angeles, California. Welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be here.
How long have you been preparing for the one-year anniversary of the elections?
Since last year.
And how have you been preparing?
We have been extremely successful in getting people to come help us and getting people to volunteer and hiring staff to be there to support these people. They understand the importance of this. They understand that we can't be there in the street with people, that we can't stand next to them. We can't hug them when they're getting beaten. But we can be online to talk with them when their friends have been arrested. We can be there online to tell them how to protect themselves. We can give them a element of feeling safe. If they can't feel safe physically, at least they can feel safe for a few minutes when they're online.
Have you noticed over the last year that there has been a learning curve? I have read that there is something called cyber jihad, that Iran's Revolutionary Guards also have a program to counter what you're doing.
Absolutely, they do. In fact, we've seen it with their propaganda that they have put out sometimes. We can see it spread throughout their own blog network that are supposed to be independent, but which are actually just parrot the regime's party line.
And is either side winning?
The way it works online is you have periods when the regime has been extremely active, when they've hacked opposition websites, when they've put out disinformation, and that would be marked as, you know, a victory at that moment. But then the Green Movement comes back with posters, videos, and just floods the internet with images of what's really happened, of the truth. So online, I would say, overall, the balance of power seems to be with the opposition, with the Green Movement.
There are a fair amount of regime supporters in Iran, and I have read that they are using things like crowdsourcing, putting up pictures of people in protests, and letting anyone who's a regime supporter tell them who is that person.
In fact, they used the Western media's photographs, too, of protesters that were smuggled out or were taken by reporters before the media crackdown occurred, and they would just go through, for instance, CNN or The Guardian, find these pictures, put them up on websites, and crowdsource it. But what's been interesting is that the opposition, the Green Movement, has done the exact same thing. They've taken pictures of police forces, of plainclothes police officers, security forces. They've put them up online and had Green Movement people identify these people, including their home addresses, telephone numbers, and stuff like that. So we're seeing the internet level the playing field in that regard.
Over the past year, the Iranian government has been very effective in shutting down most of the street protests in the country. There seems to be another struggle going on, and that's the one in cyberspace. Do you feel like you're on the front lines of another kind of struggle with the Iranian government?
The front line is now online, because the regime will arrest people and then go through their contacts on Facebook, go through their contacts in Gmail, and find additional people to arrest. So you have this aspect where those contacts were not online, then online would not be a front line as well.
Do you have some respect for how far the regime has come in understanding that the internet is a way to organize the opposition and their efforts to actually try to shut it down?
Absolutely. There was a saying my father would always say, always believe your opponent is smarter and stronger than you. And that's been the approach, you know, because many of us are Iranian, so that was kind of how we were raised with this attitude. So we have come in with that approach, understanding that they have unlimited resources. So we have always respected their ability to do this stuff and view them. We assume everything is compromised, and we assume they know everything, and that's from where we start.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much.
Cameron Ashraf is the co-founder of AccessNow.org, and he teaches at California State Polytechnic University.
By the way, you can follow this program on social media. Talk with us on Twitter at Morning Edition or at NPR Inscape. It's NPR News.
Government officials are trying to get for-profit schools to take some responsibility for their students who default on their debts. NPR's Claudio Sanchez has this report.
The U.S. Education Department is targeting for-profit schools because the amount of federal aid for students at these schools has exploded in the last few years. It's about $27 billion. And even though only 7% of all college students attend for-profit schools, they represent almost half of the students who default on their loans. So here's what the Education Department is proposing. If in 10 years a graduate from a for-profit school cannot repay what he borrowed with 8% of his starting salary, the school he attended would be banned from the federal student loan program. Harris Miller, president of the Career College Association, says that would slam the door on low-income students and working adults.
The default rate on the loans of students who attend our schools is about the same as it is for students who attend community colleges and minority-serving institutions.
Miller says the average default rate at for-profit schools today is no more than 8 to 9%. The Department of Education emailed NPR this statement, quote, "We don't want people saddled with debts they cannot pay or degrees and credentials that are of little value," end of quote. The regulations will be available for public comment next week. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Israel's attack on the flotilla attempting to break the blockade of Gaza has ruptured its once strong relationship with Turkey. The episode has also added to the strains in Turkey's relationship with the U.S. Here's NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore.
Turkey has manifestly come unstuck from its loyalty to America and the Western alliance. Back in 1950, Turks fought side by side with Americans in Korea, and more recently Turkey entered into military arrangements with Israel, the only Islamic country to do so. Turkish diplomats even tried to broker better relations between Israel and Syria. The impetus for this came from the Turkish military command, which sometimes had to override the more Islamic-minded civilian officials. But two recent issues have imposed a strain on Turkey's moderate policy that may be too difficult to sustain. The first was Turkey's decision to join with Brazil in offering Iran a compromise deal on its nuclear program. It involved a complicated swap of enriched uranium, short of what the American-led sanctions coalition demanded. The Turkish intervention, as the United Nations Security Council was moving towards its vote today, was something the United States needed like a hole in the head. Even less welcome was Turkey's tacit support of the six-ship flotilla that sought to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza, leading to a clash in which 9 men were killed, one of them with dual American citizenship. In Turkey, that has made the Gaza blockade an issue for the streets. For the government, efforts to mediate between Israel and the Arab world are off for the foreseeable future, and Turkey's support of efforts to contain Iran are in doubt. Whatever Israel's commandos may have accomplished in blockading Gaza, the cost in the closest friendship Israel had in the Muslim world is bound to be high. This is Daniel Shore.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Learn more about the music and artists you hear on NPR and discover new music by visiting npr.org/music. There you can also hear a Tiny Desk concert or get an exclusive first listen of new music. This is NPR.
The Gulf oil spill is now threatening one of the best wildlife recovery stories ever, brown pelicans. In the 1960s, the pesticide DDT almost drove the birds to extinction. Brown pelicans graduated from the endangered species list last year, NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports.
The small, marshy spots of land near Grand Isle, Louisiana, are chock full of pelicans. From the water, you see lots of heads sticking out of the grasses. It seems as if every square foot is taken, either by an adult sitting on a nest or a gangly white chick waiting for mom or dad to bring back some fish. But oil has invaded this nursery scene. Pools that look like dark chocolate syrup fringe the islands. Sticky mats of oil as small as a bottle cap or as large as a living room float just offshore where the birds feed. Biologists say they've seen pelicans desert areas where oil has shown up, but not nesting islands like the one we're looking at called Queen Bess.
These birds are on nests. They're committed to being here.
Michael Carlos is the top biologist for the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries.
Parental instinct is extremely strong, and these birds are going to stay around this island.
Carlos looks through binoculars at a bird that looks like it's been dipped in tar.
You can see the oil on that thing very clearly. With the sunlight, you can see it glistening. He's caked up pretty good.
Carlos says increasing numbers of pelican parents are getting coated when they dive into the water to fish. If they make it back to the nests and spread the oil, it can be deadly for eggs. More and more parents are not making it back. Without a parent, no stand-in will incubate an egg or feed a chick. So far, the oil has spared some nesting islands. Still, Carlos fears what's to come.
I like to kind of refer it to as almost a demon sitting offshore, you know, lurking, some kind of evil nemesis, you know, waiting to come and impact. And, you know, we're just getting small tastes of it, and that's the scary part.
The flimsy-looking bright orange boom that surrounds the island has let lots of oil through. Since April, Carlos has begged in vain for beefier booms. Now he's joined a small force of biologists rescuing birds covered in oil. So far, they've picked up nearly 400 live ones, most in recent days. More than 600 dead ones have also been found. Rescuers don't want to grab a bird that might still be able to feed a chick, so they only take the ones that cannot fly.
And they're at a point where if they stay out much longer, they'll essentially starve to death.
We pull up to a boat of rescuers in white protective suits. Biologist Kathleen Paulette has been catching suffering birds for days.
They're very oiled. Yeah, I don't know if I can talk about it, really. It's horrible.
To catch them, Paulette and other biologists plunge into the water with nets at the ready. Some birds try to escape, but most are caught in moments.
They don't really fight, so you just make sure they can breathe. And get them in a box and get them to where they can be washed off.
That's the sound of a bird being sprayed with a concentrated solution of Dawn dish detergent. It's in a warehouse turned bird bathhouse, a 40-minute boat trip from where the birds were rescued. It takes three people about 45 minutes to scrub them clean. Outside, about a dozen clean pelicans huddle together. Jay Holcomb directs the International Bird Rescue Research Center. He says these birds should do okay, but he believes most oiled birds will never be rescued, and for every adult saved, a tragedy is left behind.
The birds with the white heads are the adults, so they may have babies, and if they're here, that means the babies are going to die.
Holcomb says other adults will be too busy feeding their own young to take on orphan chicks. The federal government has just started releasing some of the clean birds off the coast of Florida. It hopes the parents do not try to fly back to their nests in Louisiana's oily waters. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
President Obama has some key voters to reassure, and that is senior citizens. Yesterday, in a town hall-style meeting, Mr. Obama tried to persuade seniors that the new health law will provide more benefits. But it's been a hard sell. And Republicans are keeping up the heat by attempting to block the president's choice to run the Medicare program. NPR's Julie Rovner has the story.
The man President Obama has nominated to head the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is Donald Berwick. He's a Harvard pediatrician and founder of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. It's a think tank which, for the past two decades, has worked to make healthcare safer, better, and less expensive. Among those singing Berwick's praises is Mark McClellan, who ran the agency known as CMS under President George W. Bush.
Don is a person who spent his entire career committed not just to talking about ways to make healthcare better, but actually helping organizations around the country change healthcare for the better. And that's exactly the kind of background that CMS needs right now in order to find better ways to support high-quality care while saving money at the same time.
But though he may be a Republican, McClellan doesn't get to vote on whether Berwick gets the job or not. And many of the Republican senators who do get to vote have been accusing him and his boss of hidden agendas.
Dr. Berwick is the perfect nominee for a president whose aim has always been to save money by rationing health care.
That's Kansas Republican Senator Pat Roberts. He and several other Republican senators have been hammering on the fact that among his voluminous writings, Berwick has praised the workings of Great Britain's National Health Service. They say that will lead him to try to impose a similar system here, or as Wyoming Republican John Barrasso put it,
you say, do I really want Dr. Berwick? Do I want somebody who is in love with the National Health Service of Britain? Someone who says they have incredible respect for the way it works and thinks it's the right way to go? Why would an American citizen want that person to be in charge of Medicare and Medicaid for this country?
In fact, while Berwick did profess his love for the British system 2 years ago, most of that speech consisted of ways that system could be improved. He hasn't advocated such a system here. Berwick's nomination, meanwhile, has broad support from doctor, hospital, and other health industry groups, all of whom have key financial stakes in how the new health law gets implemented. And it's no small job. Berwick would oversee nearly $1 trillion a year of federal spending and play a key role in some major decisions about the just-passed health legislation. In fact, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius speculates that's exactly why Republicans are trying to slow-walk Berwick's nomination.
Some of the criticism directed against Dr. Berwick has little to do with him. It's sort of a relitigation of the health reform legislation that now is the law of the land.
Holding up Berwick's appointment actually accomplishes several simultaneous goals for Republicans, says Neera Tanden, a former Obama health official now at the Center for American Progress.
One, it scares people about health care. Number two, it really deprives the agency of one of the premier thinkers in the strategy because he's silent during the process. He can't write extensively, he can't comment, and he's not there.
Tanden, however, says Democrats have a problem of their own making, that while Republicans are keeping up the drumbeat against the new health law, Democrats have tried to move on to other subjects, particularly jobs.
And so the question for them is whether they can actually walk and chew gum, defend their vote, defend the legislation, and talk about economic issues in their district.
She says if they can't, things may turn grim for the Democrats come Election Day. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.